Stones. Stones have shaped culture for as long as culture has existed. Stones have provided us with tools from axe heads to the rare minerals used in our phones. The precious ones, of course, have also served as signifiers of power and wealth, as will be seen on display in Charles's forthcoming coronation. Enter stage left, Hetty Judah. Hetty is chief art critic of I newspaper and also has mined a rich source of storytelling in stones. Her new book is called Lapidarium, and it tells the story of humanity through 60 stones that have allowed us to evolve and create over thousands of years. And it's marvellous that Hetty can join us now from London to share, and forgive the pun, a few of her gems. Hetty, welcome.
Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me, Philip.
Can you explain your book title, please?
Well, a lapidarium is literally a room of stones, a chamber of stones. And there are a few fabulous lapidariums in continental Europe. There's a very famous one in Prague. And in general, they hold, I guess, stone artifacts, fragments of stone monuments. So they're usually a bit of a jumble of formed stone. So I've really taken that word and I've expanded it. So my stone museum book is expand out from formed stones to gemstones to geological ones.
You say at first glance it may seem a rather strange book for an art critic to have written.
Yes, well, so I'm very lucky. I get to spend a lot of my time with artists, talking to artists. And I find that artists tend to be hypersensitized to subjects that the rest of us tend to grasp onto a few years later. I mean, we're used to using the phrase avant-garde when we talk about art, and we forget what that means. And it really means that these artists are out there ahead of us, engaging with the world in exciting ways. And over the last few years, I've really noticed this blossoming of interest in geology, in the idea of deep time, which I think a lot of people are fascinated by as a way of engaging with the current climate catastrophe. And there's also been a lot of interest in extractive industries, and that very much in connection with empire, which has been obviously a big subject for British artists, and the expression of power and how people express power through artifacts. And and indeed, there are many of the underlying subjects for the book, including the idea that we can think of stones as having quite animistic qualities, as having some kind of animating force to them. They're really present in art of the moment. And so all of these different subjects really started to coalesce around stones as a classification of objects.
Now, Hetty, old red sandstone relates, of course, to our comprehension, our understanding of what you mentioned earlier, deep time.
Yes, well, for a very, very long time, certainly in the Christian world, there was this idea that the earth was all formed whole and perfect in one gesture, that, you know, that Genesis really was a description of how the earth came together and that everything happened all at once. And so right up until the early 18th century, there was a date that was printed at the start of the English Bible, noting that the earth was formed on the 23rd of October, 4004 BC, on a Sunday, because of course it started on the evening of the first day. And there was this idea that, you know, everything just kind of arrived in one place. And as people started to kind of dig more and more and to be more engaged with the world around them, this idea that everything formed in one go started to be tested quite heavily as people started to find...
I'm very shocked by this revelation. I've always been a fundamentalist, and now you tell me this is not the case. Tell me about James Hutton.
So James Hutton was a very curious figure. He was one of those people that's always kind of prodding and wondering at things. And he started off as a doctor, he became a farmer, and he turned to geology really after spending a lot of time out in the Scottish countryside. So I don't know if you've ever visited Scotland, Philip, but Scotland's very generous with its weather. There's an awful lot of it. It tends on the rainy and windy side.
Mostly rain, yeah.
Rain and quite strong wind. And so there's a lot of erosion that happens in Scotland. And so when you're walking around looking at these dry stone walls or ancient monuments, you really notice that erosion happening, and you can see the rock being worn away, and you see the silt kind of going through the rivers. And this is what James Hutton started to observe. And it occurred to him that, in fact, you know, this process of the rocks being worn away and created didn't just all happen in one go, that it was actually constantly happening, that rocks were constantly being eroded by the wind and the rain, that the sediment was being carried through the rivers to the oceans and building up new layers and accreting. And so sandstone was actually forming, that sedimentary rock was forming constantly. And so this process of erosion and sedimentation and rock formation was not something that had happened once, but it was an ongoing process. And we were in the middle of a cycle of rock formation. So that was his revelation, formed in walking through the Scottish countryside. So there's this famous event that happened in 1788 when he and two friends, John Playfair and James Hall, took a boat around this beautiful area of the Scottish coastline, which is known as Sicker Point. And the coastline is very interesting because the rock is exposed there, of course. It's not like walking across a field where things are covered in, you know, grass and earth. And they were looking for something that would show that there have been these tremendous upheavals and turning points in the creation of the earth. And what they found at Sicker Point was this formation that's become known as Hutton's Unconformity. And what you see there is evidence of two different ancient sedimentary formations. And there they show that the earth is essentially rucked up at a certain point. And there's been such a movement in the earth that the layers, the sedimentary layers, are sticking the wrong way up. They are vertical rather than horizontal. And there's been tremendous erosion that's happened over millions and millions of years. And then hundreds of millions of years later, there's been a new sedimentary formation that's formed over the top. And that's the old red sandstone.
Sorry to interrupt, but we've got such a lot of deep time to cover and not a lot of time to do it in. I'd like to move on to red ochre. We've been talking recently about the vast amount of marvellous cave art in Australia. And, of course, red ochre plays a major part in First Nations cultural life.
Yes, I mean, it's the earliest art material. There has been prepared paint made with red ochre going back. The earliest we found is 100,000 years old, and that was found in South Africa's Southern Cape. So it's arguably the earliest exploitation of earth minerals. And what's extraordinary is that it's found all over the world. There's art found all over the world made in red ochre, and usually from some combination of ochre, bone marrow, and it's kind of has to be heated and mixed with other things so that it can be used as paint. So, I mean, it's been found, there have been extraordinary artworks found in Indonesia. Of course, as you say, very, very important artworks found in Australia, but also in Europe, in Brazil. So it's mind-blowing how there is this universal application of this intense red pigment.
Let's look at rather larger stones. Probably the most famous collection in the world is Stonehenge. What sort of stones were used for that remarkable building?
Well, what's extraordinary about Stonehenge is that it's actually two different kinds of stone. So there are local stones that are known as sarsens, and that's a form of sandstone that was very, very prevalent in Wiltshire. But there is an inner ring of stones in Stonehenge, which is actually made of, they're a kind of stone known as dolerite. And they are thought to have come from much, much further away, about 240 kilometres away in South Wales, which is absolutely mind-blowing when you think about the transportation of those stones. So the local stones, the sarsens that make up those great big outer ring, they came from about 32 kilometres away. And just to transport those would have taken 2 months. So starting to think about how you get stones 240 kilometres in that era, it's a little mind-blowing.
As is the case of the stones shipped down the Nile for the pyramids. Okay, but staying with Stonehenge, you mentioned some recent research about the surprising acoustics. Tell me about this.
Yes, there was this project done a few years ago that started at the Royal College of Art in London, which the idea is that they look at the landscape with Stone Age ears and eyes. So rather than kind of thinking with this modern, you know, this modern mindset, you start to think about why stones might be important, not simply from a visual perspective, but also acoustically. And they were really asking why you might transport these rather unprepossessing looking stones such a great distance across the British landscape. And they discovered that these stones in South Wales have a particular acoustic quality to them. They're what you might call lithophones. So if you strike them, not all of them, but some of them kind of make a percussive noise. So some of them ring like a bell, others sound like a drum. And you think about this great landscape of South Wales, and you start to hammer these stones, and it becomes this kind of call that rolls out across the hillscape of South Wales. So it has this extraordinary impact over a very, very long distance. It's almost like a calling sound that would come from this monument. And they've actually found kind of hollows over a ring in a ring shape about 100 metres in diameter, which they think was where the stones originally came from.
Hetty, I had no idea that Stonehenge's resonance struck a chord, another pun, with novelist Thomas Hardy.
Yes, so there was this, the Victorians were very fascinated by Stonehenge. It was really when people were starting to ask ideas about our origins. And of course, all they really thought of was this idea that this was this pagan monument, and they knew there'd been burials there and cremations. And so it struck them as this really kind of this rather violent place of death and cremation. And so at the culmination of this wonderful book, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, about this woman who's very hard done by society, she finds herself in this great pagan monument, but it's dark, so they have no idea where they are. And Tess is being chased with Angel Clare across the landscape, and they find themselves just by touch in this site, and they can hear this humming sound, this reverberation like an Aeolian harp coming through the stones.
I'm fascinated in your stories about petromaniacs, people who bankrupted themselves over their obsession with collecting stones. Please tell us a little about Me Foo, also known as Crazy Me.
So Crazy Me was a very affectionate name for this character. He was a calligrapher and poet, an 11th century figure. So he's from the Song Dynasty era China. And he was called Crazy Me because when he got this very important diplomatic post in Anhui province, he was meant to go and visit the local prefect and present his credentials. And instead, he donned all of his ceremonial robes, and he went instead and paid a visit to this famous local rock. And he bowed down in front of this local rock, and he called the rock, he referred to the rock as Elder Brother. And this became a very popular subject for artists. But there was this kind of, you know, although he was referred to as Crazy Me because he neglected his duties to go and pay homage to an object from the natural world, it was also seen as a very honourable thing to have done, because it recognised the importance of the natural world, the natural structure. But Me Foo also categorised the qualities by which you could appreciate a wonderfully worn rock. So he came up with a number of categories, including shu, which is elegance, lu, which is the ways that your eyes can travel around a rock, they can take a journey around the rock, tu, which are holes or perforations, and zu, which are the wrinkles in a rock. And the rocks that were really prized looked like these very worn limestone formations, these great big rocks with caverns and pits that were very eroded by time and the weather.
Now, petromania reminds one a little of tulip fever that obsessed the wealthy Dutch, because people spent a fortune on these stones.
They really did. There was a particular emperor that really, you know, actually kind of plundered other people's property to get his hands on the most beautiful stones. So the Emperor Huizong. And he essentially bankrupted himself, fulfilling his appetite for rocks. And so these were rocks that would go in his garden arrangements, but also smaller, beautiful rocks that were used and put on a desk indoors and allowed one to contemplate the wonders of nature while you were stuck indoors on your bureaucratic work.
I've got a little example of Gongxi on its little wooden stand, and I'm terribly fond of it. It's got some calligraphy written on the corner, which I've never been able to translate. But there are some very famous examples, aren't there?
I visited some absolutely wonderful examples at the Met Museum in New York a couple of weeks ago, and they've actually built a kind of replica Chinese courtyard there around some of the rocks, which were donated by the Boston sculptor Richard Rosenblum. So people are still somewhat obsessed with them, though it's actually very, I mean, it's a very rare obsession these days. And I spent months and months when I was working on the book trying to track down the collection. And I was using all my art world contacts, the collectors of Chinese and Japanese artifacts. And weirdly, I eventually, completely by accident, walked into a collection in London. And it was in the home of an architect called Charles Jenks, who was famous actually as a postmodernist. He was the foremost British postmodernist. And lo and behold, in this entirely unexpected setting, there was this extraordinary collection of Gongxi.
You include amber as a rock, although it is in fact fossilised tree resin, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I'm going to contest your distinction there, because one of the things I really try and do with this book, and you'll notice the subtitle, The Secret Lives of Stones, is to confuse this hard distinction that we think of between stones and life, because so much stone actually derives from life. So all of these limestones and chalks and things, they're all this stony stuff that was once inside bodies, and, you know, including coral, of course, in Australia, very importantly. So I don't think we can draw a particularly hard distinction between stones that derive from life forms and of course there's petrified matter of all kinds, including digested matter. So amber, I would argue for amber being considered as a stone, but it's fossilized tree resin, as you say. Yes,
it's so beautiful, and I wish we had time we could talk about the amber room. Well, we could talk about that for an entire program, but no time. Before we say goodbye, Hetty, one final question. Roughly how many minerals do we think there are in the world, and are there perhaps more to find?
Well, there are currently about, I think there are about just over 5,000 minerals. And of course, as I mentioned before, there's this great symbiosis between life and the mineral world. So in fact, the great mineral proliferation happened just after the great oxygenation event about 2.5 billion years ago. So life of all kinds has had a huge impact on mineral proliferation. And of course, human life has had a rapid effect on mineral proliferation. So there are about 208 new minerals that have developed over the Anthropocene, and hundreds of manufactured mineral-like substances like concrete. So these are going to be part of our fossil record moving forward. So yes, minerals continue to evolve and change, and there are new minerals being found all the time indeed.
Concrete, you mentioned that, and of course that's played a vast role in human history from the Romans.
It has, and it's the furnishing concrete with gravel is actually, I think, the largest extractive industry in the world. About 50 billion tonnes of sand and gravel are extracted every year, which dwarfs the amount of iron ore that's extracted, which is about 2.5 billion tonnes.
I remember there was a fad for pet rocks. Do you have a pet rock? Do you have a favourite?
I don't, but I have to say there's a special place in my heart for an opal from Lightning Ridge that my father gave to my mother when he visited Australia. And I wore it for a long time and then it split and I had it reformed and I gave it back to my mother for her 70th birthday as a pair of earrings. So it's not a pet exactly, but it's a rock that's close to my heart.
Thank you for your time, Hetty. That was absolutely fascinating. Hetty Judah, Chief Art Critic for the I newspaper.
Getting in touch with ABC RN is easy. Join the conversation live using the ABC Listen app's call and text features.